Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome, listeners, to The Extra Inch. My name's Windy, and I'm joined by my sidekick and best friend, Bardi. Hello, Bardi.
Hello, Windy.
And our tactics guy, and a man whose job is definitely not a risk, Nathan E. Clark. Hello, Nathan.
I feel like it should be.
Well, funny you say that. I'll come into that in a moment. Thank you, everyone, for all the emails and tweets about why you started listening to The Extra Inch podcast. It was very much appreciated. And it turns out there was no one reason. I thought there might be like a neat, oh, it was because of this thing that you got mentioned on, or this website that you showed up on. No, it's just a whole bunch of different reasons. Some people found us via like Spotify recommends or whatever it's called, and others just Googled Spurs podcast, and yeah. But it was really nice to engage with our new listeners. Appreciate all the messages. That was cool.
Are you saying you haven't put all of the data into a spreadsheet and analysed the trends?
So I feel like there wasn't enough data to do that with, but the data I did have was, there were no patterns forming, let's put it that way.
And yet we're going to discuss Spurs despite having not played 10 league games yet.
I hate you so much. I really hate you. Alex C says, can we please have another therapeutic episode? I love you all. We'll do our best, Alex. Although, to be honest, I'm not sure how possible that's going to be after this past weekend. Nathan Kino asks, how much can we blame this defeat on Nathan's Things Are Getting Better video, given his horrific recent history with videos on Spurs?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's fair. I think entirely. I do want to come back to that. I do want to like look at that in a little more detail.
Yeah,
because I was feeling kind of bad about that video yesterday, and I've
you should not. You should not feel bad about it.
I've sort of had some time to sort of to meditate on it today, and I think we'll go into more detail later.
Yeah, definitely don't feel bad. I have thoughts too. Also on Patreon this week, we put out the couple of things that were in the chamber. So an episode of Straight Off the Training Ground, the podcast I do with Chris Summersell, analyst and coach and just general legend, and also the latest episode of On the Couch, which is me talking to our ex-sub community. I pick a different person to chat to, and we hear about their lives, and there's some really interesting people in our community, and loving that series. So as ever, patreon.com/theextrainch is the place to go. Bardi, I want to start with you, because you always sum up the vibes very well.
Always the most dramatic, you mean?
A little bit of that. But I feel like you really sort of, you get it. You understand what it means to be a Spurs fan. And you sometimes take it to heart. But sometimes you kind of get over things quickly as well. I want to know how much this North London derby defeat, where did it rank, basically, in terms of the painful defeats we've had to Arsenal over the years? And how did it make you feel?
You know what? It doesn't rank that high.
Okay.
At the Emirates especially, we've had some horrendous results where we got beat 5-2 two seasons running. One of those 5-2s, we were winning 2-0. So I put them below those. I don't know if you remember the 3-0 we lost, where we conceded a goal, Gomez let it in at the near post, and then we took a centre and passed it straight to Fabregas, and he ran through the whole team and tucked it away. We were 2-0 down. There was the game after we'd beaten Real Madrid or Dortmund in the Champions League. You know, Arsenal were on the ropes, ready to be buried, and we went to the Emirates and we got turned over. It happens a lot to us. We've won there one game, maybe one in 28 attempts, I think. So this is not new. Of course it hurts because it's Arsenal. Of course it hurts because it was pathetic for 45 minutes. But in terms of like worst moments of Tottenham support in life, it's not even in Europa Conference, man. So we can get over it. Everything else we can't, but the actual result itself, it's almost as if the result is insignificant compared to the consequences or what we learned from it, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, I do. I definitely do. And that's really interesting. As a standalone result, I think that's really interesting. How do you feel about it, Bardi, as a series of results? So we heard this this statistic that had we lost 3-0, obviously it was 3-1 in the end, but had we lost 3-0, that would have been the first time in our club's history that we'd lost by three goals or more in three consecutive league games.
I mean, all records are there to be broken, but there's circumstances you can look to, the Palace game, the Chelsea game, and then this. There's things we need to learn and things we need to move on from, but I don't think this is the end of Nuno. It's still a little bit too early, but we'll get into the kind of like the details of the game, but there's disappointments to be had. But in terms of the result and the string of results, yes, they're bad, but I don't think it's end of days quite yet.
Mm. Rolling Fork said, how did we go from the first half of the Chelsea match to the first half of Arsenal from a tactical standpoint? What happened? And I can see Nathan is cramming some food down his neck. So what I'm going to do is essentially take over until Nathan's ready to speak. I've got lots of thoughts on this. And I'll start here. So when the team was announced, I was kind of like, okay, that's fine because Ndombele's playing, so, you know, whatever, like, to some extent, I'm just happy if Ndombele's playing. But I didn't spot at the time that Romero wasn't playing, and then that became clear to me. I was like, okay, yeah, this isn't so fine. And the reason it wasn't so fine is because I saw the team in detail and I was like, okay, we're not going to try and play the ball through midfield today. That's not our intention, because if you select Tanganga over Emerson, Sanchez over Romero, and Lucas over Lo Celso, you are making a conscious decision to leave out players who are good in build-up play, who are good at developing possession from the back. And that made me a little nervous. And I put a message on the Discord saying I didn't want to like ruin the vibe because everyone was a bit excited before the match. We're going to do this, you know, coys, 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 coys. And I didn't want to completely ruin the vibe, but I was a bit like, I'll be back at halftime. I hope this goes better than I think it will. And that is purely based on team selection. Now, if I'm thinking that, the players are thinking that. And as soon as that came to my mind, I thought what I'm going to do is grab a pen and paper and note down our first few possessions and see what happens. So here are my notes of our first few defensive possessions.
Oh, God.
Yeah, it's ugly. It's really ugly. The first defensive possession we have, the ball comes back from kickoff. It's shifted out to Tanganga. He kind of chips a ball forward and we lose possession. The second time we have the ball at the back, Dyer has the ball. He is kind of under a little bit of pressure, but nothing significant. He chips the ball forward and we lose possession. Then there's this like little bit of interplay where Huibier counter-presses and briefly looks like he might do something and plays in Son, and Son's in down the left and he's tackled. Then the ball is back in our defensive third again. This time it's with Lloris. Lloris plays a long ball to Son on halfway. He's pressed back. It goes back to Lloris again and he plays another long ball, which is a hoof, and Reguilon manages to create a scenario where he wins a foul. Then fourth time we have the ball at the back, Sanchez plays a long ball towards Harry Kane and we lose possession. The fifth time at the back, this 5 minutes gone by this point, Dier plays a long ball to Harry Kane. He misses it. We would have lost possession except for the fact that Dele creates a bit of chaos and manages to flick on to Son, who is offside.
He's offside, I remember that.
The first time we actually get Ndombele on the ball in their half with any sort of meaningful touches is on 14 minutes when Lucas takes it down from a throw-in, essentially beats a man running laterally across the pitch and finds Tongi, who picks out a fantastic ball forward to Reguilon, who nearly creates a chance of the dangerous cross. That's the first time that Ndombele gets any meaningful possession. And then, so basically, we set our stall out from the beginning. The intention for us in this game was to play long balls forward, to challenge for second balls, to counter-press when we didn't win them, and pick up bits and pieces from there. Why are you picking Ndombele in the team if you're going to do that? I just don't, like, if you're going to do that, at least have Skip in the team to back up the counter-press and to be solid in midfield. I just thought the team selection was bizarre. And also, like, I just hate that approach. This is not a good Arsenal team. We're giving them far too much respect in that sense. Interestingly, once we changed in for the second half, the first proper possession we had at the back for the second half saw us play into Højbjerg and then Skip and use Emerson Royale to create some triangles, which allowed us to bring our centre-backs up to halfway. And then we were let down in that particular bit of play by a poor pass from Højbjerg to Reguilon. And it's fair to say that by that point, the game had changed, the game state had changed. Arsenal were not pressing high anymore. They were happy to just sit in and let us achieve very little. But it just showed me that we changed our approach and we were trying to actually pass the ball through midfield and try and build from the back. And I was left thinking, we'd seen against Chelsea and Wolves that we were trying to play a much more progressive style of building out from the back through Ndombele and through the other central midfielders. And there was a lot of good work there. And it was the best football we'd played this season. We tore it up against Arsenal. We went back to what we'd seen in previous matches, gave up on that sort of more progressive style. And I just can't get my head around that at all. Nathan, I'm intrigued. What do you think? Why did we attempt to play in this way?
I really have no idea, man. I can't get my head around it, to be honest. I didn't clock what you clocked with the lineup. I looked at that lineup and I thought, okay. We've overplayed some of our more important players over the last few weeks because he wanted to get a result and turn things around. And now he arrives in the North London Derby with some sort of second choice players or whatever.
Interesting.
Or some slightly more defensive players, I guess. Yeah. That's not great fitness management, but I guess at least Ndombele is playing so we can still move the ball well. But no, you were right. We really did set up in every possible way. to just send them all over the top. But
yep.
I'm struggling with it, man, to be honest. I can't really wrap my head around it. I can't. Because so much base level analysis is like working on the assumption that the manager doesn't know better. And it's like, that's never the case, right? The manager always has, you know, elite level coaches know what's happening in front of them, right? Mm-hmm. And even when it, like, especially even, you know, with Mourinho, whenever I was critical of him, I was critical of like decisions he might made despite knowing what was going on, right? But with Nuno, I'm like, we started off with these 3-1-0 wins. We played badly in them. He won one as manager of the month. we played well against City. And we were playing this direct style that was very uncreative in possession. And then I made this video because over the last sort of three or so games, we've brought some of our more technical players in from the fold. Romero and Lo Celso, but especially Ndombele. And I did a video looking at how Ndombele was making a significant impact on the way that we were playing, much less on the long ball, much more about playing it through the middle and his individual creativity and his ability to like just single-handedly solve build-up patterns on his own. There's a strong pattern of he would do all of that in the first half and we'd be really good. And then in the second half, against Hayden, against Chelsea, against Wolves, he would move away from build-up. And I was saying, in the video I did, I said, I guess it must be fatigue, I guess. And it kind of looks that way because he's having fewer touches. He's succeeding at what he does less. He's moving around a lot less. I do think there's definitely truth to that. But there was this very strong trend of first half, he helps in the build-up play. Second half, he moves away from the build-up play and Spurs just play long the whole time. And our performances would be good in the first half and bad in the second half, basically. Which is not like that's not the total pattern of where the goals went, but you get the general idea. And even after the Chelsea game, Nuno said, look, we were good in the first half.
Exactly.
We have to remember how well we played in the first half. So then we come into this game, and as you say, almost all of the lineup decisions support not playing through midfield, and then Ndombele is just not involved in build-up play at all. And I can't wrap my head around it. So either it is a conscious tactical decision by Nuno to push Ndombele up. And this is something that we've seen historically with Nuno, right? This is the case of Wolves, the case of Porto, the case of Valencia. He wants to play with two high number eights who are there to win second balls and start the play from there.
What a misuse of his talents, though.
But it's just a misuse of the talents, and it's just such a limited way of playing, man. So either that is the intentional setup, or Ndombele just took it upon himself for half the time he's been on the pitch to undermine the way that we set. So it's like a weird misunderstanding of when he's meant to come. I remember like our first preseason games, Dele was playing in the deeper eight role, and people getting annoyed that he kept coming towards the play and trying to make the play. But like, it's the same thing there, is that like you need your number eight to come and help things along and to be like the alternative option, because it's like either you're going to pass long, in which case, you know, you have a variety of options, or you're going to try to do something else and pass the feet, in which case really it's that one player, that the deeper number eight, who needs to be coming away from the overloads and towards where the ball is. So I just can't get my head, I can't find an answer as to like whose decision was it for Ndombele to not participate in build-up play, and why would that possibly be?
Yeah, I mean, the tactical decisions that were made in this game by Tottenham, they're going to be studied for many, many years to come, because I've never seen a team just abandon the centre midfield before. That's surely what you should control. And there was just so much space in there. And somehow we made Xhaka look like Busquets, we made Odegaard look like Platini. And but I would have looked good in that position, taking that ball, turning, and all of a sudden then you're up against Sanchez and Dier, who were never going to break ranks and go out and attack the ball. Had Romero been there, perhaps Romero would have just gone into one of his frenzies and gone into Odegaard and stole it off him. But Sanchez and Dier aren't those kind of defenders. It was, yeah, there's that photo doing the rounds on Twitter. You might not have seen it, Windy, but Sanchez has the ball and there's just nothing but pure open green space in front of him. And
yeah,
there's not
yeah.
one Spurs midfielder in sight. And that's a structural flaw of understanding the game. And Højbjerg has been criticised, and rightly so. He shouldn't escape this. Dele has been criticised, rightly so. But I think this has got to come from the manager, no? This kind of just dispersed tactic.
It absolutely is on the manager, because with all of those early possessions that I've just taken you through, they were all choices. It wasn't like players were pressed into oblivion and so they had to just get rid of the ball. Sometimes the players had options and the choice was to just lump the ball forward. In pretty much all cases, they could have turned and gone back to the goalkeeper and built from the back, but they chose not to.
I mean, they're not... opens up another can of worms where Lloris's distribution is just not adequate enough to build from the back. We saw that quite a bit in the second half when Arsenal were maybe just pressing with one or two players. He was unable to find the fullbacks regularly.
I think that is true, but what's more important to me is that our choice was to play yeah. long, play early and fight for the second balls and counter press. And I just think as an approach to a North London derby, that's not acceptable. That's not an acceptable way to go and play at the Emirates. It's not. Arsenal are not a good team.
No, this whole narrative about this is a rebirth for Arsenal is ridiculous. Their tactic was to come out. They thundered through the first 45 minutes. Had they not scored their three goals, then they faded badly. They would have faded badly. Mm. And had the game lasted another 10 minutes, we probably would have snatched something. And they were. I don't know if you guys have ever run like a half marathon or a marathon. There's always some guy at the starting line that just pumps it and tries to do the first half marathon as fast as he can and then just hang on and try and make it to the end. That was Arsenal. And yeah, this time the tactic worked.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I've seen some football writing on the match that says things like Dele and Ndombele were anonymous. Shoibier was anonymous. And it's like they were anonymous because we chose them to be anonymous. We weren't playing through them. We were skipping them out. We were missing them out in our first phase of attacking play, and then asking them to pick up the pieces and build from that. And you're just not going to get the best out of any of these midfielders doing that. Maybe Shoibier can do it because he's pretty good at counter-pressing, but the others definitely, it's not how you get the best from Dele and from Tongi and Ndombele. It's just not. So I completely reject the idea that they were anonymous in the sense that they weren't showing for the ball. I think that's a nonsense piece of analysis. Nathan, I also want to talk to you about our plan when we didn't have the ball, because, again, this was interesting to me. First few times Arsenal had the ball in possession at the back, we dropped into our shape. We had our narrow front three and then our narrow three behind them, the idea being to stop Arsenal playing into midfield. And we've seen that throughout the season so far in pretty much every match, perhaps less so against Passos because we didn't let them have the ball so much. And then there's one occasion where I think it's like 5-6 minutes in, Kane does press the centre-backs for the first time. And I've watched it back a couple of times and I cannot see a difference in the situation, what the trigger might be that means that this time Kane is to press the centre-backs. It's completely bizarre to me. But on that occasion, Shoibier comes up, presses up behind Kane to try and stop the ball into midfield. Dele therefore has to leave his man to go to Xhaka, who would have been Shoibier's man. And Smith Rowe then picks it up behind Dele. Between the lines, he plays it into Tierney, who finds Aubameyang, and they have their first effort on goal. It's like, okay, 6 minutes in, Arsenal have already beaten our flimsy press and got an effort on goal. It was offside, but the signs were there. And I'm thinking at that point, I don't like the look of this. That was far too easy how they've managed to play out through our press. And they did it for two of their goals.
Yeah. I mean, essentially, like, in both attack and defence, we played like Nuno ball to the extreme, and Arsenal came prepared specifically for how to play against that. And you can only separate them to an extent because they do sort of combine. So defensively, like, we play this 4-3-3, and it's a very sort of three flat lines of a 4-3-3. And I think that's really effective in the mid block, but we've also wanted to press high at times, which, you know, you don't want to see as a fan. But then, like, those three flat lines become, if you prepare for it specifically, which Arsenal clearly did, kind of easy to work around because you know where the spaces are going to be. And so Arsenal made they did a really good job of sort of matching those three lines, or appearing to match those three lines, and then having specific movements into the spaces between them as the ball came forward. And so especially Dele and Ndombele sort of didn't know whether to go forwards or worry about the space behind them, and kept, you know, doing one and having the other exposed because they're responsible simultaneously for the midfielders in front of them and the sort of attacking midfielders behind them. So in the second half, we move to a 4-2-3-1, and that problem dissipates massively because you have now four different lines of defence, and Arsenal can create the space quite as well as they could in the first half. But it's the combination of like a single midfield line defensively and the lack of midfield presence offensively, the like, means that in transition, especially, we were just like, Arsenal just had like 30 yards to run at our defence with, basically, in front of them. And I don't know, there's kind of a thing here where it's like, the next few weeks are going to be extremely telling, because I kind of feel like both at Valencia and at Porto, teams sort of cottoned on. Because again, Nuno has largely played, and not entirely, but largely played the same way for his entire managerial career. Teams sort of cottoned on about good ways to set up against Nuno, and there is more than one. And this was very much that from Arsenal. That was like, you know, in like really quite basic terms, right? Like, this team commit a lot of players forward in attack. Oh, okay. Find ways to counter through their midfield. Like low level, like sort of obviousness. And so the question is this like already day one of the Premier League having cottoned on how to set up against the way that Nuno plays? Is there going to be sufficient adaptation around that, or can there be, or is this just like, are we going to see this a lot from here on? And I guess we will find out pretty soon, because if we're going to be facing teams who set up like this regularly and we don't find ways to adapt around that, we're going to have a really horrible time. If Arsenal sort of has struck gold and people and other teams aren't going to cotton onto it, or if Nuno's going to find ways to adapt around it a little better, which I don't think is beyond him, then I still think that we've generally began trending in the right direction over the last few games. But I definitely have some fear at the moment, yeah.
Yeah, I echo that, those fears that if this is Nuno ball already been found out, then we're in for quite a torrid couple of months until a decision is made. And it's just bizarre that we end up in a situation with Paratici, who's, you know, he's well versed in Italian football, and the league may not be what it once was, but there's some interesting managers there doing some interesting things with centre midfielders, and we've ended up with a manager who just doesn't believe in the centre midfield, and it's quite puzzling.
I was staggered by our tactics in the first half. I couldn't quite believe what I was watching. And the thing is, after the first goal went in, you're like, okay, you have to change something. This isn't working. This is going to get worse and worse really quickly. And we could all see it happening, and he did nothing. So first goal, it's a long ball, actually, funnily enough, from Reguilon. Easily headed away by Ben White. Xhaka beats Huijbjerg to the ball. Huijbjerg jogs back with four Arsenal players between the lines and facing our defence. And I felt like if Huijbjerg had run back with any sense of purpose, he could have ultimately got into the right area to stop the pass. And that's frustrating, because that's not Huijbjerg. That's not the player he is. That's something very unique about that. He's not normally someone who gives up, but he gave up in that instance. Second goal, Kane is pressing Ramsdale, actually. So there's, again, another example of him pressing all the way back. Again, don't know what the trigger was. Huijbjerg follows to Xhaka, Dele follows, Tanganga is then late to follow Smith Rowe, probably because our press is completely uncoordinated and poorly coached. Smith Rowe plays it first, one touch to Tierney, into Aubameyang, and this is where I think Bardi's point from earlier is absolutely correct, because if Romero is playing, I don't think Aubameyang has a single second to play the first time pass. But Sanchez is slow. He's slow out to him, and he stands off him and allows
medium risk of a red card is the trade off there.
Yeah, absolutely. This is absolutely completely fair. Romero might foul Aubameyang. He might go through the back of him. He might get a booking. But
probably a booking, yeah.
But we don't concede the goal. And then the third goal, Kane loses possession outside the Arsenal box. It doesn't look great for Kane. It's a bit clumsy, but it's one of those things. Sometimes players slip on the ball, whatever. We have six players ahead of the ball. So three outfield players behind it, Huijbjerg and centre-backs. Again, can Huijbjerg foul Odegaard to break up the play? Maybe he can get to him. We're a bit unlucky because Kane chases back and makes a pretty good tackle on Saka, but it falls quite nicely for him to stick it in the back of the net. And 33 minutes into the North London derby, it's game over. By that point, it's too late for Nuno to do anything to change the result. He's given up his chance. He must feel at that point that he's completely got his team selection and his tactics wrong. And after the game, he's like, I picked the wrong players for what I was asking him to do. And
yeah,
I agree. How do you think you did, Nuno?
I mean,
so he took the blame, which is sort of like a breath of fresh air. Due to the dramatic lowering of the bar last season. So a few fans are sort of happy to see him say, oh yeah, no, I made some mistakes, but like that's the bare minimum.
Yeah.
But he also said like some players, without naming them, some players sort of failed to follow my instructions. My instructions were an issue, but also there was failures within that. I'm trying to work out, like, is that defensively or offensively, and then what could he mean? Because like the offensive setup, like with the high central midfielders, is like they weren't just high, which they often are, but they were also quite wide. Mm-hmm. It seems like there was a focus on like trying to quickly go from the long ball to like the wide overload, like winger, central midfielder combinations. Yeah. You can sort of imagine Ndombele receiving a second ball and playing Sun down the left side or whatever. But I mean, Kane was just sort of largely mismatched in his competition for the long ball. And any time we went anywhere else, we just weren't in a good position for it. Essentially, Arsenal were just good at like clearing over the very high midfield line, so to like avoid competing for second balls in the area. When the clearance was short, we looked better, and that's how you got that sort of like Dele heading it on to Sun, but mm-hmm. Sun's offside early on. Or maybe Nuno is alluding to defensively, and he just like, I don't know, either he wants the midfield line to be like absurdly aggressive and just like be nearly glued to the back three and just abandon Arsenal's attacking midfielders in acres of space behind there and just like be on Xhaka, like don't let Xhaka receive the ball at all there, which kind of does explain like Højbjerg's sprint, but like that just seems like so high risk, and I mean it kind of did materialize that way. So I'm kind of at a loss for like what he wanted, like what he felt was like misdone by players, as opposed to that. Because to me, it just seems purely tactically. And you can say like, oh, you look at this clip. Højbjerg and Ndombele are failing to track a runner, but it's like how many times do you want them to make like backward sprints to their own box because the ball's gone over the head again and again and again.
Right.
So yeah, I don't know. Arsenal score 3 goals from like maybe 1.5 expected goals, so it does seem a bit worse than it is in terms of like the actual chances, and we got sort of a few shots off down the other end, so it seems kind of close on like expected goals or on a shots based kind of analysis, but like tactically it was really really one way.
I mean, we have been quite negative, and of course we got smacked up in the North London derby, but I thought Emerson did all right when he came on. I thought Skip showed us exactly what we were missing, and Skip's kind of in for some unfair criticism recently, but I think you see the value he brings to this team, and him being there reduces the kind of weight on Højbjerg and Ndombele a little bit as well. So I think Skip is a crucial player to us. I thought Sun showed a good intensity. I thought Reguilón did okay. But that's class with straws. But there are some good things to take from this, you know? There are some good things.
Yeah, I feel like the second half was Nuno essentially saying, let's just have the ball a bit more and play, sit a bit more compactly and not concede any more goals. And if we score one, then great. And I thought the subs, in order to achieve that, then the subs were the correct ones. You know, Skip, who is clearly going to be a lot more involved in deep possession. Emerson, who I think is really good at building from the back, is a lot better than Tanganga technically in terms of taking the ball, receiving and giving. I mean, he's just a lot better player than Tanganga in that position.
You could see how reluctant Spurs players were to pass to Tanganga in build-up.
100%.
I mean, Arsenal were leaving him spare a lot of the time.
Yeah, and that's not to criticise Tanganga. He's a very, very good player, a good young player. I don't think he's a right back in a possession team, to be honest. I think Emerson absolutely is. I've been quietly impressed with Emerson so far. He's had difficult matches, but like when he's had the ball, he's made me think, yeah, I like what I'm seeing here. So yeah, we closed out the second half and we won the second half, I guess, which is small mercies, I suppose. And actually, interestingly, Emerson, I compared his pass completion in the opposite half with Tanganga's, and it's 20% higher. His pass completion is 20% higher in the opposition half, which is, I think, quite telling. And Nathan, I don't think you should feel bad about your video, because clearly there were massive improvements in the Chelsea and Wolves game.
Yeah.
Clearly. And the frustrating thing to me is we had a really effective, aggressive press in those games, really effective. And I'm looking at the Arsenal lineup. Arsenal notoriously nervy when they're under a bit of pressure at home. Just go hell for leather like we did against Chelsea first half. Get straight up their throats and see what kind of chaos you can cause at the back. See, like, what, wait for them to make some mistakes. How many times over the years have we profited from Arsenal making mistakes at the back? Especially in recent years. Just, you know, why not repeat that tactic? It worked so well in the first half against Chelsea. It worked well against Wolves. I don't get it. I just can't work out what the plan was. It's bizarre.
Oh, shout out for Gil as well. Hill, Brian Hill. I thought he looked neat and tidy and something a little bit better than Lucas Moura. I would like to see him start in more games in front of Lucas.
He really did. He really did. But I just think that Nuno needs to have a rethink about his overarching plan, because like you say, we've got some good players here. Mm. We can play possession football if we want to, you know. Skip in midfield, very good high volume passer, and Ndombele, one of the best ball progressing midfielders in the world. I think Dele in his box to box role has done more than adequately so far, and I like Lo Celso on the right because he allows you to have another possession player dropping in and helping out in midfield, and I quite like him receiving on the right touchline as well, because he's facing the right way with his left foot. He's very one-footed and he can see a lot of the pitch. So I think just go back to that and just play that for 4, 5, 6 games and just see what happens, because otherwise, Nuno, you are curtains, mate. You are not going to last long in this job.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Do you think, Bardi, that if we were to lose against Villa next week, or even worse, let's imagine that we don't beat Moura in midweek and then lose to Villa, do you think Nuno could be gone?
No, I don't think so. I think it would need to lose a couple of Conference League games. It would need to go out of the cup and lose a couple of league games. I'm not sure who we got after Villa, but I don't think it's still too early to sack him. It's looming and the pressure will build on him, but it's too early. I mean, if we go for him, who do we hire?
So this is the thing, isn't it? Who do you hire? And I was having a WhatsApp conversation with Tetrunk last night, and like, what viable alternatives are there? Appointing a manager midway through a season is really, really difficult. So you'd probably end up with an interim. My first thought was Eddie Howe. Eddie Howe's the interim. And I'm not thrilled with that idea. I'm not thrilled with that idea at all. So Tetrunk put a tweet out, like, would you sack Nuno if the alternative is interim Eddie Howe? And yeah, obviously people were voting against that. They don't want that to happen. What I would say is, at least Eddie Howe plays progressive football. You're going to get Ndombele and Lo Celso on the ball more. You're going to get Kane having more touches and probably able to get more shots away. But Howe has also had some catastrophic failures.
Please stop talking out for Eddie Howe.
We could. Fonseca's still available. Fonseca's still there.
Yeah, but he thinks that because we wanted to buy a defender that we wanted to play defensive football. Like, from the like, top down, I don't. Like,
Gattuso, bring back Gattuso. Maybe.
Jesus Christ. Yeah, I mean, at least Gattuso isn't our manager. That's one good thing.
Right? I think we'd have more points if Gattuso was our manager. Would it be, you know, for all the wrong reasons as well, that surrounded, but I think we'd be doing better with Gattuso than with Nuno.
Hashtag yes to Gattuso.
Nathan, what do you think? Do you think he would survive a defeat against Villa? I mean, we're going to lose to Villa. We're going to lose to Villa if we play this game.
No, we don't lose to Villa.
If we play anything like what we've played in the first three games or against Arsenal, we are 100% losing to Villa.
Windy's going to be all right. So you need to hit the bottom of the swimming pool to know where the top is. You know, it's okay. We've hit it and now we're going to go up the right way. We're a bit bloodied, maybe got a fractured neck, but we'll be all right. We'll get through this. He'll start playing Romero. He'll start playing, Lo Celso. He'll play Skip. He'll play Royale from the start. We'll be okay.
Next three league games are Villa, Newcastle and West Ham. That brings you up to 9.
9 points.
Should be Newcastle.
Okay. So, like, what's unacceptable from the next three games? It's less than 4 points?
I mean, I would have said, at the start of the season, I would have said you want 6 points. You want 6 points.
Yeah.
But you want or 6 points.
But we're talking about like now. Now we're talking about like he's in terms of like him risking his job. What does he need to get from the next three games to keep his job from here on? Well, next three league games, because we do have two Europa League conference games within that. Or are those relevant to the conversation?
I think they are relevant if we lose both, because then that puts us in an awkward position to get out. But I couldn't tell you one thing about Mura, and so I think we'll beat them, and we'll probably beat Vitesse as well.
I think we'll lose to Villa and West Ham, and we might beat Newcastle. And
is that equal?
I think he might go. To be honest, the thing is, I think the performances in some senses are more important than the results in those three.
Yeah, I agree with that. The performance has got better recently.
that needs to continue, because if we go back to this lump the ball forward and hope for the best style, and we can't see any progress, I think he's gone. And the thing is, he already looks like a beaten man. And I know that's like... body language analysis is not great. He looks broken already, and this is his highest profile job he's ever had. The pressure is unreal. He's following Jose Mourinho. There is a lot of latent resentment at the club. There's a lot of frustration from the fans, and he knew all this when he took the job.
My position, I think it was a poor appointment. I think it didn't fit the brief. But I also think that, like, it's just too soon. Obviously, like, if we spend the next three games evacuating midfield and getting done on the counter, then I kind of have to change my mind. But for me, like, there's just no point of, like, sacking a manager before, I don't know, December, November at least. Like, so I'm kind of like, well, let's, like, because what is at risk with keeping him? Like,
European qualification.
And the money
that brings.
But I think that was already, like, up in the air going into the season. You know, we were talking about maybe fourth, maybe fifth. I think that, like, you know, do you still get Europe if you go down as far as eighth? This, I guess it depends on how other teams do in various competitions, doesn't it? It's sort of a bit up in the air. So it's not like that was sort of like on the line. That was assumed. It is on the line. So I don't know. For me, you should give him several more weeks. But I think that if we don't see tactical change at the very least, then I certainly won't be surprised.
What might help him is that after the Mura and Villa game, we've got four away matches in a row.
Okay.
I mean, if they were at home,
why does that help?
Well, because I don't think the crowd
booed off the pitch.
I don't think the crowd are going to welcome this style of football at all. I mean, I think if we play this against Villa, there'll be boos at half time and full time. Yeah. Villa scare me, to be honest. They're playing a new system. They're playing 3-5-2 with Ings and Watkins up front, which I think will rattle us anyway, to be honest, because we are just... Well, we've conceded 9 goals in our last 3 Premier League matches. We're struggling defensively. So I think that's going to be a problem. But also the 3-5-2 means there's a matchup in midfield. We haven't got numerical superiority in midfield. And we saw against Chelsea how that turned things.
One thing that is baffling to me is that against Chelsea, we pushed the fullbacks high and dropped Højbjerg in order to get Ndombele on earlier. And then, like, we played strict to the back four.
Yeah.
So, I do wonder if we might see 3-4-3 as a sort of, like, panic button response.
Interesting.
But, like, I don't think it's necessarily a good idea or suits us or is right or solves things. I think it's just, well, let's try this kind of thing. So, I mean, maybe that results in getting, you know, a ball player on the ball early, but I don't think it's, I don't know. I don't understand why we... we play this idea versus Chelsea in the first half. We're impressed with it, and then we avoid recreating it.
We're gonna do a Conte's Chelsea. We get pumped by Arsenal. We'll have a slightly better second half. Then we're gonna go on a 13 match winning streak, and we're gonna end up winning the league.
I wonder if the idea was like this last. Three games, we've been good in the first half and bad in the second half. So what we'll do to throw Arsenal off is we'll switch it. So we'll just spend the first half making a non-game of it. We'll just send it long and defend and send it long and defend. And then in the second half, we'll switch to, like, Højbjerg drops in and Ndombele comes deep, and we'll try to play through the middle then. And then now obviously that goes completely to pot, because Arsenal are prepared for how we set up in the first half, not how we played against Chelsea in the first half. I wonder if that was the idea.
Because not a bad otherwise, in theory.
That, I mean, that, it feels a bit tin pot, but it, tin hat, sorry, but it's also...
the only
Yeah, well, yeah, it's definitely tin pot also.
tin everything. Tin pot
and tin hat. Yeah, nice. But, like, I don't really have any better ideas.
Yeah. JC says, lads, do you think changing to a 4-2-3-1 with Dele playing in a more natural 10 role would improve things at all? I'm also thinking that might give Kane more confidence that he'll get better service, so he may perhaps stop playing as a deep-lying playmaker. It might even encourage a higher press. And my response to that is, yes, JC, I absolutely do think that would help, but it would involve Nuno completely changing his philosophy and style of play, so it's clearly not going to happen. But hopefully if we appoint a more progressive ball-playing manager with a ball-playing system in the future, that might be what we see.
We can't be doing next manager analysis now. We can't. I think 4-3-3. So that's what we played in the second half, and again it means that we defend with four defensive lines. And so that works for us because of how Arsenal specifically set up for that match. But I think it could work for us for a spell of games. I do think that it means that Kane is closer to some other players and closer to players who aren't wide of him, which I think can help.
I thought Kane has some great touches against Wolves. I don't think Harry Kane is
the problem.
I think getting the ball to Harry Kane is the problem.
Okay.
I really thought he was good against Wolves. In not loads of touches, but when he did have the ball, it was all effective stuff. It was lots of great first-time layoffs, clever passes, getting his head up quickly, all the stuff you'd expect from Harry Kane. I really liked the Wolves' performance, if I'm honest. I know we conceded two rough goals from Ndombele mistakes, but I generally thought the performance was positive, and the XG reflects a very dominant performance too. There was some good stuff there, and that's why the Arsenal game is even more frustrating.
I think a firing Kane scores two goals, and we get out of that with a draw. He snatched his chances. I was a bit critical of him, but I don't think he was the problem in this game, though. There's far bigger issues at work than Kane not being able to move around.
Yeah.
I think 4-2-3-1 could be interesting for us. I think that there could be. So I think that, like... I think it's a way of Ndombele affecting the play earlier.
But he's going to play him to the 10. If you just know, if it goes to 4-2-3-1, he'll play Ndombele.
Which is what we saw in the second half against Arsenal. And then, like, it just... So that solves nothing. That gives, well,
he will play Huey Bear and Skip as deep-line midfielders, and Ndombele as a 10.
That would be miserable.
Yeah.
I think that would be terrible. I think that will see him...
It might even be worse than what we've seen so far. Yeah. Matt D, I quite like this one. He says, question for the pod, what's the highest cost you would pay to go back in time, not fire Poch, and back him? Would you cut off a finger? Shag Flav? Don't know where that came from. Admit Italian football is the best, Wendy and Nathan?
Flav's a handsome man.
Yeah, I mean, that's not, doesn't feel like a high cost, does it?
I'm in.
My immediate response.
Italian football, bloody hell.
my immediate response was that I would cut off Bardi's finger. That's a high cost for Bardi.
It's a high cost. I mean, always with Tottenham, we always end up looking back. But things weren't that great under Pochettino when he left, you know?
No, they really weren't.
They were pretty bad. We'd been pumped by Brighton. We got pumped by Bayern Munich. It was kind of end of day stuff. The Sheffield United game, it was a VAR decision that saved us. Things were bad then.
And we were having ball progression issues.
Exactly. We were lobbing it long and hoping for the best and relying. It was almost very Jose Mourinho, like that last spell under Poch. So no, I'm not going to cut my finger off, have sex with Flav, even though he is a big, handsome, sweaty man. I'm just not that fond of the Pochettino end of reign, to be honest with you.
I get that. It's the feeling of progress, isn't it, that we all miss? It's the upward trajectory. It's watching players improve week by week and feeling like, yeah, we've really got someone here and knows what he's doing. The fullback whisperer as he was in his first couple of years. And then, you know, this burgeoning pressing style, which we'd never seen at the club really before, or certainly not for many, many years, probably since the 60s. And it felt great. It felt really new and fresh and exciting. But Bardi's right, that tailed off big time. And there were huge issues. And I don't subscribe to the theory that it's all because we didn't refresh the squad. I mean, I think that would have helped, but I definitely think there were other fundamental issues at play. That said, if we could go back and try refreshing the squad, yeah, hell yeah, I'd absolutely give it a go and see what happens, because it's not gone well since. I wanted to ask you this one, Nathan. This is from Lars Arpel, who says, your talk about fans making up excuses for Lo Celso really made me want to ask you, why are you doing the same for Ndombele? There are obviously plenty of excuses that can be made, frequent managerial changes, and Mourinho, I guess, for a start. But on the other hand, I feel we as fans have been entitled to see a hell of a lot more from our club record signing. With the wages we pay him, three times as much as we pay Lo Celso, as I understand it, also comes an increased responsibility, and he simply hasn't lived up to that with the level he's performed at Spurs, not to mention the frequent focus on wanting to leave. I don't doubt his talent, but I do question whether he's shown enough of it to warrant the soft touch you give him on the pod compared to other players signed for a lot less money and paid a lot less in wages. If there are mitigating circumstances to this view, could you please help me understand them? Best, Lars.
Well, I definitely apply the same excuses to Lo Celso, who I also think is a really good player, and I'm also really sort of excited for down the line. But I don't hold it against fans if they are sort of frustrated by Ndombele based on sort of like the expectation and reported wages and stuff like that. I just think that blame needs to be spread around pretty evenly, I guess. He isn't blameless. I'm sure he could like have done more to apply himself better, but I also think that like we as a club have been a mess ever since he arrived. And the same for Lo Celso, same for Bergwijn.
And I do think you see the difference he makes when he's in the team and getting on the ball. You look at that and you think, oh my God, he's literally transformative for our team, the way we play football. That's not an excuse. It's just a reason why we should back him or have faith in him to be good, because he's really good. He's a really fantastic footballer. And I agree. I think there are probably instances in the past where perhaps he could have done more to help his chances and his form. But it's been a shit show, and like if I were Ndombele, I'd want to leave. I'd definitely want to leave. Like, he doesn't need this. He doesn't need this in the best years of his footballing career. This is a mess of a club. He could be playing at a higher level for a better club in a team that wants him on the ball lots. I get it. Bardi, any thoughts?
What can you say, really? Yeah, we've talked Ndombele to death. He's a fantastic player, but we just don't see enough of him, either because of him or the tactics. Something is not right. And I don't think we're going to fix it right now under Nuno, and that's quite sad.
Jam Scones says, if you had to replace Nuno with a previous Spurs manager who wasn't Poch, who would it be? This isn't a hypothetical where it'd be them at their peak. This is based on literally bringing them in now. So you can't say, I want Bill Nicholson.
Okay. So they have to be alive, you mean? Yeah. Okay. Fine.
So who do you appoint?
I appoint AVB. Bring him back.
He's the only one that I can possibly make a case for, basically. Yeah. I just... And that it's not an exhilarating, like, promising one, because I think that, like... You know, there are significant downsides for the AVB, but yeah, like, definitely he would be the only one.
There's literally no one, is there? There's no one else.
I mean, there's our friend Christian Gross is still knocking around. He's won a few things since he left Spurs, but you know, that is the Swiss League. Or he recently sacked by Schalke earlier this year, so he's still knocking around. You know, okay. I mean, it's either Gross, AVB, or Redknapp. I'm not sure what happened to Ramos or Santini, but I guess it's one of those now.
Mm. Yeah, Jam, try better with your questions next time. That was it wasn't as good as it sounded. Which one should we go to next? They're all a bit shit.
I'm leaving that in.
If you could move, what about this one from Ram? If you could move your seat.
Okay, question from Ram. If you could move your seats anywhere in the stadium, where would each of you sit? E.g. centre sideline view or being close enough to hear coaching instructions? Ooh. That's interesting because, some people like to be right near the action, close up. So close enough that you can shout at players and they'll hear you. Some people like to be at an end. Some people like to be on the side. Some people like to be close to the dugout. Some people like to be where the atmosphere is. Is there a compromise there, Bardi, for you? Where do you like to be?
I don't like being too low. I think if you're too low, like row 1 to 10, I don't think you get enough. You don't get enough idea of the space on the pitch and how the team is laid out. I don't like being behind one of the goals either, because then it's great for when the ball's at one end, but then you know obviously you can't see what's going on in the other. To be high up across on the centre line behind the dugout would be quite interesting, but then that would probably put me within earshot of Daniel Levy, and that would probably earn me a ban at some point. So I'm going to stick with a corner. I'd like to sit in a corner, but maybe at the moment I'm row 57, so I'm way, way, way too high. So I reckon it's in a corner about 30 seats up, 30 rows up. So you get enough of the atmosphere, but you can also see the pitch and see how the teams, what setup they've got as well. Mm. And near the staircase going down, so you can dash out for a beer as well at the time.
good tactical thinking there. Yeah, so I've always chosen to be fairly high up when I've gone to see Spurs play, and I generally prefer to be behind a goal in an area with as much atmosphere as possible with those restrictions. But I used to go and watch the youth team quite a bit at Hotspur Way, and it's quite interesting being literally on the touchline, like close enough to touch players as they come over to take a throw. Bardi's completely right, you can't get a sense of the spacings at all well, it's quite sort of hard to judge that, but what you do get is a real feel for players' technical ability, and you can make a good assessment of like their touch and vision and passing range, and you can tell a team's intensity from being there as well, really well, because you're sort of seeing them how quickly they're like pressing or how hard they're going to tackles, whether the tackles are necessarily hard. So it's quite fascinating. But yeah, just never, for some reason, never chosen to be that close at White Hart Lane or now Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. So yeah, slightly higher up as Bardi would. How about you, Nathan?
So I spent a lot of the last several years sitting near my dad because he's a season ticket holder, or he was a season ticket holder. And in the old White Hart Lane, he was right by the managers. He was like, well, he was right next to the press box, but with the manager sort of walking around in front, the away manager, closer to the away manager than the home manager. And that was interesting to like see what was going on in the dugout a little bit. But yeah, really low down. And obviously, the old White Hart Lane was like a really incredible stadium, and especially towards the end, a really special atmosphere. And to be that close down to the pitch had its own benefits, but I really couldn't see what was going on at all. Mm. And then when I did sit old and new stadium, when I have sat where you get the best sort of tactical view, which is high and on the sides, those tend to be the quietest part of the stadium.
Yeah.
The most expensive seats and the quietest part. So I think if I was like, if I was on the called like the 1882 club, high up on
south stand, on
the,
yeah,
in the south stands, that might be the compromise where I can. I think I watched the Ajax game. It was a listener actually had a spare ticket for me, which is really sweet. I was fairly high up south stand. And I think that you get a mix of good atmosphere, assuming the game's going right, good atmosphere and a good view. So I think that is it like some sort of weird VIP thing in the middle of the South Stand,
right in the
1882 club?
Yeah, right in the centre of our famous wall, there's a VIP £2,500 season ticket area or something.
Jesus.
Like that. Yeah. I'll have one of them. But like... but like right on the edge of one of them, so I'm not like properly in amongst them. You know what I mean?
You're one of those guys that goes to Cineworld and sits right next to the VIP seats, not quite in there.
Yeah. Rubbing shoulders.
Nice. So there you go, Jam Scones. That's how you do a question. That was good content that you got out of us there. Well done, Ram. It's been a bit of a miserable podcast, really, but I think that's a reasonable response to the shambles that was the 3-1 defeat to Arsenal. So hopefully Spurs will produce something better in the coming week and we can have a bit more of an upbeat conversation next time around. But look, it's not all bleak. There's a lot to be excited about long term. I really do feel still that we're well set as a club. You know, the revenue from the stadium is pouring in now. And that means in the coming windows, for the first time, we can actually spend on wages. We can break our wage structure a bit and we can attract top players. We're going to be fine. It's just we need to get the next managerial appointment spot on.
The thing is, this is kind of Tottenham. This is so we deal with distress and bad results a lot better than most other teams, because this is if you've been supporting Spurs a certain amount of time, this is just how it is. You don't win at Arsenal. You know, I said at the start, we've done it once in 28 games. So dealing with the depression and everything else is just part and parcel of being a Spurs fan. I think that's what makes our fan base very unique compared to them lot. Just don't overreact. Things are bad, but things will get better. It's not the end of the world. We're all still alive. We're all still happy-ish. And, you know, things can only get better.
That's not true. No. That's not true. And you know that's not true. Let's rein it. We can don't invite chaos into our lives in that way. We're not under threat of relegation, right? I don't think we are. Think that things could work. I think the next few games are going to be really, really telling and quite definitive. So tune in
and make sure you're buckled up.
What?
What is that? Buckled up.
You've been listening to The Extra Inch. Thanks to Nathan A. Clark for production. Thanks to Bardi for being Italian. Thanks to Adam Gardner for the artwork. Thanks to David Lindmer for our intro music. You can find him on Twitter at Davey Shambles and his SoundCloud, E. Lindmer. Do check him out, he's great. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at The Extra Inch. Email us via podcast@theextrainch.co.uk and subscribe via your usual podcast platforms. And if you do enjoy the podcast, consider leaving us a rating and review. That would really help.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.